Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, I would love to hear from you. Send me an email. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. We're past 130,000 downloads. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I could not have done that without you. I really appreciate your support and listening, sharing with friends and family. Just wonderful. And as you know, I do so many shows on a variety of topics, so I'm glad that you find them interesting, from health, arts, politics, so on and so forth. Thank you, thank you, and thank you. Well, today I am so honored to have a poet, a playwright, a journalist, an editor, a factory worker, a father, a grandfather on the show today. I actually knew him, or I should say he knew me, when I was a kid, and I reconnected with him again on Twitter, of all places. But he is a magnificent writer. He has several books of poetry. He's a Pew Fellow. He's a Fulbright, NEA. He has a Chinese connection, which we'll talk about. He's been in a monastery, I believe. He went away for a couple months. So he's a very deep guy, very meditative type of guy. You know, nothing will get past him, so to speak. Good morning, Afa Michael Weaver. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Good morning, Joy. It's a pleasure to be here, virtually.
This is like... I know. I just said when we connected on the phone, like, wow, after, what, I don't even know, more than 30 years maybe even?
At least 20.
That I think maybe I've seen your face, or maybe I'd spoken to you, or you spoke to me, because I was a kid, so I was in my own mind running around probably. But thank you, thank you. I was mentioning to you earlier that I was trying to figure out which poems to focus on, which issues to focus on, and you don't have any bad poems. I mean, I'm a little mad at you about this. Like, you got to write some bad poems, you know. So I don't have so many choices.
Well, that's mighty kind of you. I'm sure somebody would disagree.
Well, let me tell people just a little bit about you. Some people may not be familiar with who you are. You are from Baltimore. And you were born as Michael S. Weaver, but you came into the name, which I'll ask you to explain in a little bit. Your first book of poetry was Water Song. It was published in 1985, and you received an NEA Fellowship for Poetry. You also, since then, have written several books, the most recent one, The Plum Flower Dance, poems 1985 to 2005. You also are a playwright. You wrote a play called Rosa, which was produced in 1993. You are a Fulbright scholar, a Pew Fellow in poetry. You are currently a professor at Simons College in Boston, Massachusetts, and you're the chairman of the Simons International Chinese Poetry Conference. And there are many other things that I didn't mention, but just to give people a little background, you have a breadth of work as a poet, as a professor, as a connector of cultures, so to speak. But let's start with the Plum Flower Dance. Wow, I was just engrossed in it, and as I mentioned to you, it made me think about writing a poem for Mr. Softy, of all things. Rather simplistic. But I just had this thing in my mind about almost like a love affair I had with Mr. Softy. And when I was a kid, I was able to run really fast, and we connected greatly. But as I got older, I felt like Mr. Softy abandoned me and it wasn't as patient. But no comparison to the lovely poems in your book, The Plum Flower Dance. And I love the way that you use the elements in the titles of each chapter. Talk to the audience about the significance of these five elements and what they mean in Chinese culture.
Those five elements are one theory of how reality manifests that comes out of ancient Chinese culture. And the interplay of those elements and different patterns, according to that theory, constitutes reality. It also plays into theories of health and well-being in Chinese medicine. the elements refer to different parts of the body. And, for example, the element water corresponds to the kidneys and so on. And I know it best, I know that system best through a system of Chinese boxing that's called Xing Yi Quan, which I've been studying with my teachers since the year 2000 now. So it's a kind of embodiment for me, the idea of the five elements.
Well, I thought that was wonderful. And also the title of the book, The Plum Flower Dance, is that connected to the plum blossom and then the song that's connected to China?
Well, it's connected to a system of divination for the I Ching, a mathematical system of divination. However, a friend of mine in Taiwan, a poet by the name of Yang Zhe, who's also an editor at the China Times newspaper, literary editor, he told me, he said, I thought that could also be constituted as being oversexed. I said, okay, Yang Zhe, thank you for that.
He called you out. You know, art does that. Sometimes our art shows who we truly are. You know, sometimes people are actually afraid to be artistic or to go into their art because whether it's visual or dance or theater or, in your case, poetry, it really it put a light on maybe who their true essence is. I don't know, you know.
Well, you start digging into that deep ocean of language and symbols, icons and imagery. Anything might connect in there, so. But especially going from language to language, going from Chinese to English and back, you can carry lots of things with you. It can bring lots of things back.
Well, let me talk to you a little bit. Now, before, you know, you're an illustrious poet now, but you worked in the factories in Baltimore with your father for more than almost 15 years. Talk to me about, or talk to the audience really, about your transition from the factory. And then you got the call that you got the fellowship. Talk to us about that transition, the feelings that you had, and maybe a sadness maybe of leaving the factory, but hope for the future.
Well, in 1968, I graduated from high school. I was 16, and I went to university, the University of Maryland, that September. I was very young, and I had no social skills whatsoever. So I stayed for 2 years and dropped out, came back home to Baltimore. Only a 45-minute drive from College Park, and went into the steel mills where my father and several of my uncles worked. And I joined the military. I volunteered. And so I spent 7 of those months in the steel mill, another 5 or so in basic training, and came back to the steel mill. And then I went to Procter & Gamble in the spring of 1971 and stayed there until January of 1985. And it was during that time, especially at Procter & Gamble, that I wrote consistently while I was working and was a very strange person. And I also I also wrote for the Sun Papers, the Baltimore Sun Papers and the Afro-American while I was working at Procter & Gamble, which amazed and confused my coworkers there. But in that last year, 1984, I applied to Brown University. I remember telling my coworkers, they laughed. They said, you're absolutely crazy. You're not going to Brown University. They said, you're going to die in here with us. I said, no, I'm not either. And I had also was negotiating for my first book, and I had applied for an NEA, and, you know, things all came in that January, 85. The NEA came, and I was beginning to sign a contract for the book. It all came. And then that April, Brown, Jack Hawks, who was alive at that time, called me from Brown and said, you know, we're waiting for you to come up here. I said, well, I'm on my way. So that's essentially
wonderful.
The story, yeah. Yeah.
Now, a lot of your poems, well, in the Plum Flower Dance, a lot of trauma happened. And also I was reading on your blog, you had written a piece in April about the trauma that children deal with and then how that's manifested in their lives, but in society as a whole. You really, in your writing, try to connect that we are not on this island as an individual, but that we are also interconnected with nature. You write a lot about nature and things, but also with the greater macro systems and the communities. You've had some trauma in your life. Are you comfortable talking about I mentioned earlier about you had a problem with your heart.
Yes.
Would you mind talking to the audience about that experience and what path you took to deal with that?
Well, the heart was another manifestation and a history of manifestations of having been a survivor of child abuse. I was victimized as a child and sexually. And so that caused many problems. But in 1995, I got tenure from Rutgers. I was living in West Philly at the time. And then 2 months later, I had congestive heart failure. And, you know, one of the ongoing problems in my life had been depression and PTSD. And I had been taking at that time a medication for it that had several side effects, including raising your high blood pressure and your weight because it's a sodium-based medication. So I'd gotten really heavy, and it also can contribute to congestive heart failure, that particular medication. And so there I was, and I landed there in the hospital, and the nurse and I watched the 4th of July fireworks from the window of my room, and I having gotten tenure from Rutgers with distinction, but I had worked too hard and was carrying the unresolved issues from my childhood, and after that I started working on that, and that kind of work is a work of a lifetime. You're always in recovery from that kind of thing. But my heart is a lot better now, so it functions normally. I stay on my diet and I exercise. Every now and then I'll get a buffalo wing, but I try not to.
The buffalo wing calls. That almost could be the title of a poem, you know?
Yes.
Well, in the book, The Plumflower Dance, you have a piece called American Income, which you won the Pushcart Award, which is a very distinguished award that is given out for a literary award. Would you mind reading that piece, American Income, and then we can just talk about that a little bit. I mean, you don't have to read the whole thing, but up to wherever you feel comfortable.
Okay, sure. American Income. The survey says all groups can make more money if they lose weight except black men. Men of other colors and women of all colors have more gold. But black men are the summary of weight, a lead thick thing on the scales, meters spinning until they ring off the end of the numbering of accumulation, how things grow heavy. And it goes on from there. But the poem basically says that it takes the philosophy that suffering is an opportunity for growth.
I think you mentioned in another article I read that you went away and you were in a monastery, or you were somewhere for several months, and that really helped as a catalyst or ignite your writing poetry again?
Well, I was living in Taiwan on my sabbatical year from 2004 to 2005, and I was studying Mandarin over there. And a friend who runs a monastery on the east coast of the island asked me to come and teach Tai Chi to the nuns. So there I was teaching Tai Chi to the nuns in Taiwan. And but also, I had been working so hard on the issues of my childhood that I had essentially stopped writing. I hadn't actually been on a regular writing schedule for 7 years. And it was in that monastery that I started writing again, and wrote the first poems that are in the book that's coming out next year, The Government of Nature. So it was in that place that I actually got going again with my poetry after a long break from it.
Now, this is an interesting picture. People may not really know this, but you're very tall, dark-skinned black man. I don't know how much you weigh now, but, I mean, you have a presence. I remember myself you having a presence about you. And you're in Taiwan teaching nuns Tai Chi. I mean, this is a crazy image. As an African American male, I've read in different interviews how that affected you and how you don't go certain places because people are staring at you with a certain expectation of who and what you might do. How do you deal with this? And how have you come to peace with this? Has it gotten better for you when you go places now and you know that stare that you get that, you know, people don't know you're a poet or a professor. They just see a, you know, tall black man, and they don't know what you're going to say or what you're going to do. How do you deal with that in your mind, that confrontation on a daily basis, maybe?
Well, I understand that if you are a tall black man, that the chances are you're going to have some issues around that. So I'm not alone. And I've been working, and I think with some success to having some serenity, which is not to say I don't get angry or disappointed. But there's also a class issue that plays into it in different ways, too. So being working class brings another level of complexity to the way that I am perceived. But I do know that, and I mean, I have, you know, every day an opportunity to see how people respond when I walk into a space, and sometimes it's just, sometimes it's a little, it's so much frustrating that I get really, really annoyed, but at other times I just ignore it and keep going. But I do understand that it's not just me that has to deal with that. It's the it's the idea of what a big black man is in the American consciousness, you know, which is a whole issue. That's a long conversation, but it is that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, you know, my father, he was like 6'5". My stepfather, he's about 6'5". You know, a hefty guy, and but he was rather gentle. You know, guy, he used to read to me, and you know, I mean, he had, of course, an angry side, but in terms of what people, he was an artist. He had a different side to him that people initially didn't see, because all they saw was this, you know, tall, you know, hefty, you know, African American male. Now I have a brother who's like 6'6". He's not as hefty, but you know, he has a crazy head of locks, and it's a serious issue that black men have to, as you say, continue to deal with. And but I think at some point you do have to make a choice. Some days to ignore, and other days you may have to confront, you know, the issue. Now, let's talk about the new book that's coming out. It's coming out in 2013?
Yeah, probably next February, early March, I suppose, yeah. And it's coming from
the Government of Nature.
Right, the University of Pittsburgh Press, yeah.
And now, I was mentioning to you, I was reading, you know, The Plumflower Dance, and then I started reading The Government of Nature, and I was like, wow, so many connections. In The Plumflower Dance, you had a poem about the snake that you were holding in the science class, and then there's a poem in The Government of Nature about the snake, and then there's a poem about the horse in Plumflower Dance, and then you have the elegy for the Appaloosa's mother in this, and then I get to the end about some notes, and I'm like, oh, it's going to be a trilogy. You know, so we are going to be looking for writing from you for a long time, and I just want to wish you that much success in continuing to write, because it's so wonderful. Would you mind reading a piece from The Government of Nature?
Sure.
Maybe read the Appaloosa or the one about your heart. I'm not sure. Whichever one you're comfortable with.
I'll read the one about my heart.
Okay.
It's called When My Heart Failed. A top floor in Victorian Philadelphia, the night sounds, the tap and blast of gunfire. Above my landlord and landlady in love since childhood, the house or tree itself, the windows, sudden spaces and leaves, roots running down to where there is no sense of what roots do, under a map's wishes, a slice of cheesecake at Sam's, the store with the dog that never moves, the steps I know by heart from tree to tree, cracks in the sidewalks, signed by my feet after a year here, tearing away at strange feelings and memories. I have come to have a high noon with the past, to meet the maker of sadness inside me, and tonight it is one slice of cheesecake and no soda. I hit the sidewalk and feel the feeling of turning to cement where flesh should be, trudging instead of walking, my chest full of some new mix like a cake batter that needs more vanilla extract than hot butter, or a throat jammed with a goodbye, somewhere between a sigh and a smile. My chest has a diamond where my heart should be, a puzzle's pieces. Each tree a rest stop, 5 minutes to go, 50 steps, and I cannot count because the night looks like having lived to be a kind of success, second to what grows in trees without light.
Wow. Wow. That's all I can say. Some of your poems, I was reading them and I just got sucked in. Now, the poem is sitting right there, full on the page. I could skip around and see the end, but I get sucked into the middle, and then some of your poems you just slam with like a hammer, you know. The one about the horse in the plum flower dance, I was so sad, I almost cried because she went mad and then you had to give the horse up, and I was like, wow, he's really taking me through some stuff. You know? But then you have some, you know, beautiful, some light poems. Everything is not heavy, and then you do have the lover side, not over sex, but just a gentle lover side, you know. I actually thought the image that came to me, almost as if you were a whale, and that whales are so wise and all-seeing, kind of quiet, but then they can become boisterous, and they have this spout. I don't know, the poet whale, I don't know. That's for some reason that came to my mind.
Or the whale could surprise you and jump straight up out of the ocean, you know.
You know, right, exactly. Now, some people that you admired, I was reading you were close to Lucille Clifton. She was a poet laureate from Maryland. Talk to me a little bit about that relationship.
I met Lucille in the fall, winter of 74 and 75. And Lucille was my first major influence in terms of a living poet that I knew and who gave me lots of information about poetry. She helped me, you know, lay the stones in my foundation. And she believed in me, and she gave me a space where I could believe in myself. At that time in my life, I was having all kinds of problems, a failed first marriage. We lost our first child, and it was just horrific. And in the midst of all of that, I met Lucille Clifton. She was a kind of angelic entry into my life. And so Lucille had her own issues with childhood abuse. But now that I'm 60 years old, I can look back and I can see how I learned so much from her in an unconscious way. Because I was always impressed by her lyricism, how she could compress all of the social and personal into something that was so striking in the line. And now I understand why I was so drawn to her and how she influenced me in ways even deeper than I imagined.
Now, do you feel that you have such a great influence? You're a professor also. And what do you hope that your students will take away from your courses?
Oh, they're at Simmons College in Boston. Mm-hmm. I hope that they will take away the knowledge, of course. And most of my students are white, but not all. And for many of them, and also for some of the black students, they never had a black professor before. So I hope that they will take away the content of the course, but also remember what it was to learn from someone that society teaches them has nothing to teach them.
That's very important, and that's a continuing issue. I had author on recently a book called Fraternity and how Holy Cross Seminary had tried to bring African-American males up there, and one of the African-American males was Clarence Thomas, and how they had to fight to get, you know, black studies and black professors. And even to this day, I told her, I said, that's still an issue for students. They're going to colleges and universities, and they still feel isolated at the college because maybe they don't have someone that looks like them teaching the subject that they are trying to learn about. And so the stereotype that, you know, there are no African-Americans in this field, no, that's not true. So it's still an issue. I think we have a question from a caller. You're calling, good morning, you're calling from 202 area code? Good morning. I guess they just want to listen. That's okay. You can listen. I see you guys in the chat room. Thank you so much for listening in, and I see people on the switchboard. Thank you for calling in. So in terms of, you talk a lot about your mother and father. You had very different relations between the two. Your father really wasn't a talker, and not until your mother passed away. And then you had a really interesting poem about your mother in the Plum Flower Dance about eating chocolate. That was so eerie for me. Your mother was melting the chocolate, and I could just almost smell the chocolate and taste it because hello, my name is Joy Keyes, I'm a chocoholic. the things that kids see, because I'm a mother now, and I realized, you know, as I got older and wiser, and sometimes I'm wiser, that my daughter probably saw things about me that I thought maybe I was hiding in my actions. As a child, and now as an adult, when you reflect that, do you have any compassion for your parents and what maybe they had gone through as when they were children, you know, and that made them who they are?
Absolutely. My father was born in 1922, my mother in 1929, at the beginning of the Depression. My father was an adolescent during the Depression. My mother was a young child. And so I was raised by people who knew the worst parts of poverty and racism and the social trauma of that. And I understand now how hard they had to work. And I understand how difficult it was to make a life for, you know, their five of us kids there in Baltimore. And so when I think back to my mother eating that Hershey's chocolate there in the kitchen sitting by herself, she was consoling. And in today's world with therapeutic awareness, we would say she was medicating whatever was bothering her at that time, whether it was the stress of maintaining the household. My grandmother lived with us, and we took care of her for the last 16 years of her life, so my mother had a lot of things on her plate. And so at 60 now, I understand these things. And before my mother passed, she had a conversation with me. She called me over. She said, "Michael, I want to talk to you because I'm going to die, and I want to have a conversation with you." And we did. We had a conversation one spring day in the bedroom. I'll never forget that as long as I live. And she was a very courageous woman, and she told me she wanted me to be strong. She didn't want me to fall apart because she knew she was going to die.
Mm.
So, yeah. And then my dad passed in 2003. My mom passed in 1982. And I lost my son when I was 20 years old. My first son, my second son's alive and well, and I have a granddaughter and step-grandchildren. But I've seen a lot of loss, personal loss in my life.
And you, the poetry is helping you. I feel that it's helping you and cleansing you in a way. And do you feel that that's what it's doing for you?
Well, you know, my own philosophy of art is that we're born with whatever gifts and talents that we have. And we're also born as extremely sensitive and vulnerable people. And so things hit us, and it hit us really hard in life. And if we can get through them, those experiences sharpen our skills and our talents, you know.
Mm,
and I try to, I try to discourage people who like to think that trauma makes you an artist. I don't believe that at all. That's a false notion.
That's like an old. I tried to tell my daughter, you know, about that because she's going to be going to art school soon, and I said, don't get sucked into that idea. You know, that pain. You have to be in pain to create. That's not good. One book that really helped me, I think, really dispel that myth is The Artist Way. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that book, but that's a wonderful book. I really suggest that to people who are artists, but people who are non-artists, to connect to their creativity. But we're out of time, Afa Weaver, and I want to thank you so much for coming on. I want to encourage everybody to check out your books, The Plum Flower Dance, and also in 2013, The Government of Nature. I'll be giving away a copy of The Plum Flower Dance, so you want to follow me at Joy Keyes on Twitter, become a fan on Facebook. Also follow Afa _ Weaver on Twitter and check out his website, which is Afa, A-F-A-A, Weaver.com. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure, Joy. I really enjoyed it.
You have a wonderful Saturday, okay?
You too.
Thank you so much. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. I just got off the phone with award-winning poet, professor, playwright, Afa M. Weaver. I'll be giving away a copy of his book, The Plum Flower Dance. So follow me at Joy Keyes on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Stay tuned. I'll be speaking with singer Brad Sharp in just a couple seconds. Have a wonderful Saturday.